braiding three strands, common factors, common elements, peer delivered services, and effective training. We haven't heard about that for a while. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Janet Walker.
Okay. Thanks, everyone. So like Mary Ann Center, we got funded first 10 years ago. And so we're younger than some of the other centers. And my colleague, Lori Powers, who knows a bunch of you guys, and I were some of the main motivators behind getting that center started. We had been working pretty extensively out in the treatment as usual or services as usual field, doing observational studies and collecting data. And I think that two of the main observations that we brought to the work were, first of all, that young people, especially who were in services going up towards 18, where they were supposed to be getting person-centered planning, and Lori's work was primarily in schools through the IEP and the transition process, and mine was out in community mental health through wraparound, was that these, despite the principle of person-centered planning, no one was really asking these young people what they wanted, and they were getting very canned plans that were service heavy. I think that the other thing is that when we looked at the young people who were getting past the age where their parents were making them go to services, and especially as they went past 18, they weren't engaging in services and they weren't being retained in services. And I think this is something that underlies all of the work that we do when we look at practical situations now, that young people still aren't really coming to services and they're still not staying in services. And for the most part, in your basic out in the world treatment type situation, we don't know what happened to them, why they left. Mostly what their transition is, they don't come back and we don't really know why. And I would say that that is still one of the huge pieces of reality that is behind the work that we do, is that we don't really reach a lot of young people and they don't necessarily want what we have to offer them. So that was one of the things that we started out with, which we felt like gave us kind of carte blanche to start thinking of stuff in a kind of a new way. I think the other thing that was very in the air when we were, 10 years ago, we'd been doing EVPs for a while, but I think we were also reaching a point where some of this information that has only started to now be coming out in sort of codified research, because it took the realization, then the plan, the research, then the do the research, then the publish the research. So people who were having those, I think, same feelings about that time are now publishing, right? And so what do we know that EVPs kind of have a downside, or it wasn't the answer to everything that maybe we thought it would be. And that part of the problem is the lack of sustaining of EBPs you can look at this study. This is a new study, fairly new study. We have citations here. That fewer than half sustained over 6 years. And those are places that really tried to implement them, that put all that money into, and we know what some of those costs are. And the costs were cited as the top barrier, and that probably the issues really had to do, a huge part of it had to do with the cost related to ongoing training and in assuring that there was high quality practice going on, and that training and coaching was the largest cost component. And then there are probably more studies, but this one was really interesting, was looking at a mental health center that was implementing trauma-focused CBT. The mean one-year cost to the agency is $65,000, and that was the ongoing cost, not the first-year cost. And similarly, per client, almost $1,900. And so it's kind of no wonder, really, that EBPs in a community treatment center become such a difficult proposition, because you have a mixed clientele. Not everybody needs TF-CBT. What if you're trying to implement five different EBPs, et cetera? So basically, let's see, I did this slide. It's a little maybe difficult to see, but that was $90,000 they were spending on those programs the first year on average. And again, per clinician, 11,000. So you can see these are not trivial sums of money. And again, we found, if you sort of put that together with some of the other studies, the idea that people just, they make that initial investment and they kind of realize they can't keep going. So there's money that's kind of gone down the tubes for all of that. So what we have found, and actually we're finding 10 years ago, was people were doing what they call the light version of EVPs, right? They would do some of the implement, some of the training, maybe the short training, maybe they get a couple people trained and then have those people come back and try to train everybody else. In contrast to the EVPs that come with that whole suite of implementation supports, usually they have the pre-implementation planning and they have the working with the agencies and they have all of that coaching and ongoing quality and all that kind of stuff. That in the what you have when you're just sort of implementing bits and pieces of different EVPs in a sort of mix and match kind of way, is that you end up with that eclectic, unstructured practice, which we know is really pretty ineffective, and that there is lower client engagement and low effectiveness, as I mentioned. So what we also know is that providers believe that they are integrating elements of EBPs into their practice, but typically the research shows that they're not, and certainly not to the level that they think that they're doing. So when you go and actually video or tape record them, or nobody tapes anymore, audio record them, you find that they're doing a lot of this time spent in what's called chat. It doesn't seem to be related to any active ingredient of an actual practice, and is actually negatively related to client engagement. So I already mentioned, you know, if you just do the training and you don't do any follow-up coaching, if you send your people for a week, which is still what we see, I would say, most of the time when you look at community mental health centers or regular practice in communities, that there's pretty much a chance of zero practice change as a result of that. That there's a reliance on supervisors to somehow help with that. Most often the supervisors, far from being expert, maybe not have ever been trained in the practice at all, and certainly no more than the people they're supposed to be supervising. And we also find, you know, there's a lot of this idea that train the trainer is going to solve the problem, but we know the research that looks at train the trainer shows that the quality of training and the quality of practice falls off with every step removed from the original purveyor. And then, of course, there's just the reality that people are constantly changing their jobs. So you train someone to be a specialist in practice A, either they quit, they're gone, they move to practice B, what they're not trained in anymore. And so this obviously makes it, again, a difficult to justify the investment and the cost associated with evidence-based practices. The figures that are available, we don't have super good figures on turnover in our various areas, but they are somewhere between probably on the low end 20 and on the high end maybe 40 or 50%. And we looked at one practice that's common for now being extended up to young adults, wrap around the care coordination agencies. It really varied a lot by agency, but there were agencies that had more than 100% turnover in the wraparound care coordinators every year, or in the last year that they reported on. So obviously, there's a lot of difficulties that are attendant with the sort of original maybe vision of implementing evidence-based practices. So another option that people have been exploring is something that capitalizes on what is held in common across effective practices, and that would include evidence-based and empirically supported practices. And that includes sort of the elements or bits of intervention, sort of what do you do? So what are the actual activities that might be part of it? And then the common factors of relationship. And we were talking about this is really that gets to that principles and whether you can look at fidelity and principles. So this is our sort of language around that. Is that how do you develop the relationship that fosters engagement and alliance? And we know that alliance is also strongly associated with outcomes in mental health treatment. So in children's mental health, there's actually been quite a bit of exploration of modular mental health, modular treatments, where the most common elements have been sort of explored. There's sort of a limited menu. You pick off the menu, and you're able to apply those flexibly. And then there's a sort of a series of again, it would sort of be that principle, but relationship and relationship building strand that goes underneath it. So it's a little bit mix and match, but it's more structured and it doesn't require learning a lot of separate IBPs and implementing separate fidelity assessment, et cetera. So that's kind of interesting. So what Lori and I kind of came down to when we were working on this was that if we were able to identify things that were common across different approaches, and we had pretty strong ideas about what those would be, that we could then implement them with high quality across a variety of different specific interventions, and that that would address a fair number of these issues here. Because if people churn to a different job, they would still have a skill set that would actually help them to implement with quality in the new job. And so it was also our pretty big conviction that if we let young people also be more, have a stronger voice, as we mentioned in the beginning, they had a stronger voice in determining what they were going to be doing in their larger approach to services or treatment, that there would be, they would choose more community participation versus clinical goals, and that that was sort of the premise of our original RRTC, which was focused on community participation. And basically we were saying, well, the services are kind of there, but the community participation focus is often falls away. So we wanted, again, I think that one of the issues, I was just mentioning it to some of conversations that I had with you all during the day so far, is that people who are learning multiple evidence-based practices, they're exposed to so much information. It becomes difficult to become expert because there's so many things going on. And again, we sort of had the idea that if we could really identify some of those shared aspects, people could develop over their careers or over their exposure to these different interventions, a real level of expertise that doesn't necessarily develop if you're constantly being told that what not to do this one, but now you're doing this one kind of thing. So that was some of our original thinking. Again, this is research that we published after our first RRTC, which we're really focusing on this idea, but the same, we had already started to do this work prior to publishing. This was sort of a culmination. So one thing that we did was look at service approaches, and these are sort of comprehensive service approaches that were being used with young people where there was some level of kind of, we're gonna do an overall plan and then fit the services in. So this might have been care coordination. So we looked at, or something called transition facilitator work, as in the TIP model, wraparound, renew. We looked at a bunch of different types of these approaches that had evidence specifically for young people in the transition age years. And we also looked at things like expert guidelines, consensus, et cetera, and really found these sort of key areas, probably won't be a surprise to anybody, of things that were considered fundamental to making successful programs for addressing the needs of young people with the highest level of mental health needs. And I think that a lot of these actually would apply in any, even a smaller level program. And that the top one being that you actually listen to what they want and what they say. And I mean, in a way, this is kind of a no-brainer, but I will tell you that it doesn't happen that much. And later on, I will be talking about the research that we've done lately, where we've collected thousands and thousands of hours of practitioners working with young people as part of our training, collected video. And, you know, I think the thing is, it was always assumed that this would be something that would be easy for people to do, so nobody really bothered to teach them how to do it in any detail. And they believe that they're doing it. They recognize once we start working with them with their video that there are some areas that they could improve, and they do improve quite quickly, actually. So anyway, you know, the whole strengths perspective of fostering, we call it being sort of motivational towards working towards community connections, so to positive people, and what we call context, which is anything from maybe a sports group or a casual club or even a peer group to something as formal as a college or a job. And that also there is a need to support and motivate acquisition of skills, specifically self-determination skills, and the skills to function in positive relationships or contexts. And once those pieces are kind of in play, then maybe clinical services become a part of building one of those, of building one of those or more of those areas. So again, when you think about this in terms of the common factors and common elements, the elements are, I don't think I have to really go into them in detail. I sort of mentioned them already, but that's sort of what you do, and then how to do it is how to do it in that, in the principal kind of way. And I think it was Michelle that mentioned earlier today that you can, and we feel that we've been pretty successful in finding ways to ensure fidelity to these actual principles, that it's possible to watch, get agreement, and get a reliable system for assessing the extent to which people are implementing these things. So these, this kind of general approach, and again, you can then you can specialize and tweak and change things around what the content is, but this core of things was at the center of a bunch of the work that we've been doing, but in particular some of the studies that we started in 2009. Like Mary Ann's Center, I think we feel that incorporating young people's voice into everything we do is not just sensible, but it's essential, and it's also a lot more fun to do things that way. And you end up with stuff that's kind of different. And as I said, I think we were very open to things that were more different. So we had two randomized studies that we did in the first funding cycle. And these had been things that we were exploring prior to that funding that were developed through a very full participatory process with young people and also other stakeholders. And we also did, during our first funding period, some qualitative research and theory development. And we've developed that theory through a process of structured stakeholder review. I think the other thing that's important that doesn't get mentioned in a lot of research reviews, but the minute that you bring young people into the process, is that it's really good to have some fun while you're doing this thing. And frankly, we've been really intentionally trying to think about how to make our interventions fun. Because again, that engagement piece is huge. And if people actually find it a positive sort of valorized thing versus some kind of aversive, where I think a lot of young people experience the therapy situation as kind of aversive, maybe they will actually start showing up. So joking around, is part of what we try to do. So just as if you're interested in reading up on any more of this, we, besides that article, we also, our first Data the Science conference really focused on this issue and the process of validation that we did extensively with stakeholders and that culminated in the State of the Science conference. So Better Futures this was a project that Lori and her team was working on. And it was looking at transition to college or post-secondary training among youth with serious mental health conditions and who were either current or former foster youth. This is a subpopulation that has abysmal rates of completing post-secondary or training. And the intervention was actually quite successful. It was based in this, again, the sort of core ideas that I mentioned previously. It incorporated near peer support. So these were young people who were in college, or some of them were also in like master's level students who had also been in foster care. It had, I guess I'm not really listing. So they also had a summer institute that was part of this. It somehow dropped off the slide. I was looking for it. So they came on campus. They did fun activities. They did bowling. And they also had coaching. So those kind of skills coaching that Michelle was talking about. And they also had these bi-monthly meetings where they talked with, they kind of, the group nominated the kind of people that they might want to come to talk to them. So they had people who were involved in, they had college admissions officers, et cetera. I mean, and they after the first one, every 2 months, they combined a fun activity with a session that had someone come to visit. And after the follow-up was 6 months after post-intervention, and there was markedly higher post-secondary participation in, again, that's either training or education, hope, mental health empowerment, self-determination, and there was a sort of a trend towards improved quality of life as well. So that study, I'm going out of order a little bit, but just thematically then in the current funding cycle did a follow-up that was supposed to address, this is a randomized study that's just wrapping up now, maintaining those young people in college. Now they weren't, most of them were not young people who had participated in the original projects. This is a new group of young people, but looking at the situation and how to ensure that they were thriving once they got to college. It includes, again, near-peer coaching. And there was an interesting aspect of this, which was a network of college champions, which was people around the campus in all sorts of different areas of the campus who had agreed to be available and supportive if there was anything that kind of fell under their purview that could be helpful to these young people, whether that was advising, accommodations, a specific department that a young person might be studying in, et cetera. And again, the preliminary results are quite positive for the intervention, but we haven't finished with all of the follow-up data yet. So another strand that we were working on, and this is the one that my research focused on, was looking at working with young people who were, again, were receiving these comprehensive treatment planning strategies to develop something that would increase their skill level at doing actual youth and young adult driven work and doing strengths-based work, et cetera. Again, this was a process we worked through developing with young people in Oregon who had been through the very highest levels of mental health services, multiple 20 foster care homes and placements and everything. And they were our key collaborators in developing the overall process. So, again, I think I mentioned a bunch of this stuff, but one of the things that we found out through qualitative research that we did in the first part of our center was we went to people who were doing empirically supported, these kind of comprehensive, empirically supportive approaches, and we interviewed care coordinators or treatment providers who were identified by their programs as being particularly adept at these approaches. And they were quite confused, actually, about how to implement principles. And some of the principles more so than others. But I think that the other thing that was interesting is that they were particularly also unclear about how to increase the self-determination skills among the young people that they worked with. There, I think, has been an assumption, and I feel like this was true in my work with families when we were working with kids, that somehow those skills would just be developed by exposure to this care coordination process, and somehow kind of by osmosis they would acquire these skills. So what we really wanted to do was also to strengthen the ability of providers to really know how to teach and what to call these skills and how to refer to them in a consistent way and do those things that we know are conducive to learning. Again, you know, I guess just as I was saying before, we had exposure to a lot of data that was showing us that these things really weren't in place. So we did a randomized study with young people who were getting wraparound as it's normally implemented. These were young people up to the age of 18, so not specifically the young adult population, although in the intervening time, lots and lots of young people up to age of 24, 21 are getting wraparound now because of the way that age of children's services are now being extended up to higher and higher ages in more and more states. So what we had an intervention that was basically an intervention where near-peer coaches that we trained from our university went and just basically worked with the young person to help prepare them for the team, to help prepare them how to talk to their team about what they wanted, and to help the young person work towards ensuring that their team members actually did what they said they were going to do as a basis of responding to the young person's ideas for the plan. And we found that our findings strongly favored the intervention condition as far as young people's participation. So we actually video recorded their participation in the first meeting after we had completed we called it an enhancement intervention. Their alliance with the treatment team was higher. The meetings were more productive and better, that everybody thought that the meetings were better. So there had been some idea that by engaging the young people more, we would crowd out the families or the other team members. That was not an issue. So now in the current funding cycle, we decided that a lot of these skills were actually transferable to the peer support role as well, and that in the meantime, we have been hearing from a lot of young people who are engaged to do peer support in kind of this more system of care environment, that they really didn't know what they were supposed to be doing, and they experienced quite a bit of distress around not feeling clarity or effectiveness in their jobs. So what we wanted to do was a kind of a skills enhancement that would also build clarity around the role and, again, really define practices and skills that they could use from the moment they got started, like how to open the conversation and a series of kind of both, as I mentioned before, those elements of what to do, as well as the more kind of maybe deeper level principles of how to do it. Training was delivered or co-delivered by peers, and we did this all, I'm going to talk about it a little more lately, remotely over a four-month period. We were able to provide individualized coaching based on using videos of them working with the young people on their caseloads. And we found high satisfaction. We found that they were able to do the elements, essentially the activities and practices, and we were also able to show pre-post improvement in the peer support specialist skills in each areas, and that was assessed since we had videos of their work. We were able to look at it so-called objectively, as well as by their pre-post reports of their self-efficacy. And we also, I think this was really a kind of a cool finding that we saw decrease in their anxiety about their ability to be good and at their jobs, essentially. And just one other project that we really like that we're trying to take in a different direction is this Meaningful Networks model, which is a set of workshops. I want to call them, they're supposed to be basically fun get-togethers that is really focused on building self-efficacy around developing social networks and community participation, and that there's some of that supported activity that we talked about. There's some one-on-one follow-on that goes along with that, and that really explicitly recognizing that having fun and doing things that you like recreationally, interpersonally, et cetera, is a completely valid way to support mental health and well-being. And we have the pilot test of that wrapping up now. And our actual goal is to try to figure out a way to do this online in a really fun and engaging way, in particular because Oregon is a super rural state. And we are really interested in also finding out what it means for community participation for young people who are really, really rural, and whether we can build some level of online community intentionally for them and with them. So anyway, going back to effective training and coaching, which is the other piece that kind of wends its way through this. One thing that we discovered, both the project that Lori had developed and in our project, that we were using a video coding platform initially to give feedback to our coaches and our peers and near-peer coaches so that they could learn their work. And what happened was we thought, well, wow, we trained them in 6 to 8 weeks to do an intervention that had an impact, that we were in a randomized study able to show that this had an effect. So this seems like maybe a good basis for working on a training approach more that would be more robust than and could have farther reach, because you don't have to go there. go to wherever the trainees are. So we were able to, out of that, develop more formally a training process that incorporated elements of what we now think of as evidence-based practice-focused staff development. So what does it take to really get people to change their practices? And that a crucial kind of elements of this includes the observation, some level of observation of practice and feedback to that person. And that can be either live or via audio or video recording. Feedback in a manner that is connected to the intervention theory so that people can understand how does this fit with the big picture of what I'm supposed to be doing, but that also is based on objective criteria or some kind of reliable system so that people don't think they're just getting random stuff that you decided to say, but rather that if you ask me or if you ask Tamara what's going on in this video, we would be telling them basically the same thing. And that also people are not considered trained until they're able to demonstrate a certain level of proficiency. So, again, this just, I mean, if you think of the blue bar as where you have to get to actually get practice change, it's quite difficult. But if you look at sort of results of meta-analyses, what you see is that exposure to new information leaves a pretty large gap between being able to talk about something and being able to do it. Even practice with feedback in the basic, like role-playing, et cetera, that you can demonstrate the skill in the controlled setting, usually the transfer of practice into real-world settings is pretty close to zero still at that point. So what it takes to fill in the gap, again, is that piece of something that continues over a period of months so that you're able to have cycles of feedback so that you can improve and get better. And sometimes I think about it as the difference between handing somebody the piano songbook and saying, here, go play it, versus getting some lessons over a period of time. Just some quotes from training, meta-analyses, et cetera. You know, training alone really doesn't help much. And still, that's what we see primarily, frankly, in your sort of as-usual training situations. So another key piece of it, true, is why observation is so important. This is from the huge amount of research there is on how bad people are at rating their own level of skill at things, and that's everything from driving to implementing this kind of thing. And the original study, it's got its own name. You've probably heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect. It's very famous. But people are not only inaccurate reporters of their own skill, but actually people who are bad at something are actually tend to rate themselves higher than people who aren't, which actually kind of makes sense because you don't know what you don't know kind of thing. But yet most of our professional development in our field is based on self-report brought into supervision, et cetera, which is kind of in some ways a little discouraging. So what we wanted to do, and so we had iterations of what we call our virtual coaching platform, which we developed at Portland State University. And we now have, counted up our users. We have almost 5,000 active users of VCP around the country, not all doing transition age use stuff, but mostly doing very aligned practices with this whole same value base that we're talking about. Some of the advantages to this, so the VCP allows you to do that training over time because you're not restricted to going for a week because it's cheaper to travel and cheaper to bring everybody together, which is really what puts a lot of parameters around the kind of training that we're currently able to offer. So what trainees can do, they can log on to VCP and watch examples of actual practice. So we have acquired through authorizations the permission of lots of our participants to use their videos for training purposes. And so we have capitalized on this in all sorts of trainings that we do. It's extremely valuable to have real practice models, both of what's going well and what's kind of not going so well. And we recognize that in any excerpt of anybody's or any sample of anybody's practice, there's some good stuff and some not so good stuff going on. We call that improvables. That allows users to upload videos of their actual practice. Trainers can watch the practice. The system comes with a flexible way of coding so that you can code for whatever you want at whatever intervals you want. and it'll generate a feedback report, and you can also clip, so make out of the audio, out of the ongoing file, you can make little segments that you can then tag for the person to look at later or for you to review in a feedback session with that person. So people, their trainers are able to identify specific strengths and improvables. And again, over time, you can start with looking at the basic stuff and focusing on the basic stuff, moving to the more advanced skills later on. This is a little, just a screenshot of a, kind of a basic version of this. We're in a, currently in a rebuild that's gonna allow for a whole bunch of more cool stuff. And we're hoping that'll be online within a year. We did a study, and this is just a pre-post study, but looking at the possibility, like how well did our remote coaching work, and we were able, we have quite a few sites that are now using AMP on contracts, so we're, you know, this is outside of our immediate RRTC work, but this study was funded through RRTC, looking at a secondary analysis of the data from the trainings. That we were able to do this process, so essentially 4 months, kind of like a semester of college, maybe, where you got 8 web conferences, so they were basically going every other week. In between, you were asked to upload videos. You had, you would get for each one, you would get individualized feedback call. Usually those really are about 15 to 20 minutes is after the first one, so really looking at strengths and improvables. You have access to also watching your whole video on VCP if you want to watch the whole thing or any parts of it. And then you also have homework, so there might be some other little elements. I'm going to show some of those in a minute that you might be doing. And then there's quizzes and passing the benchmarks of reaching a certain score on the reliable scoring index that we had. So people really liked it. We have very high satisfaction. And again, through watching the videos, we were able to essentially say that people were, their skills were developing, and they also reported that their skills were better pre-post. The time, the total time, that actually should say 20 to 24 hours, is not that different from sending your staff to 4 or 5 day training, which again is sort of the typical modality. It does have its own challenges because of having to identify times for people to really do that work and not letting, you know, kind of everything else squeeze it out. But those are challenges that are not insurmountable. And I think for any of you who have been to in-person training and watch everybody run out of the room with their crisis phone calls, it's not so perfect that you get their perfect attention when everybody's sitting there for 5 days either. Also, we think that we're getting our costs down pretty well, and ultimately, we feel like this is something that if you were implementing it on to scale, you could have a cohort starting every 3 or 4 months, and that means that new staff could be trained. You wouldn't have to bring the purveyors back for $20,000, you know, periodically. So you, first of all, you wouldn't have people doing, who are hired to do this intervention, waiting 6 months till they're trained, which we know happens all the time, and you also wouldn't have to do the expense of a full training if you could just send someone to the online thing when the next one started. So we are thinking that it actually could be very cost effective as compared to that kind of no coaching option to do a kind of a full best practices or a pretty full best practices model. Obviously, there are the other implementation supports that go around that as well, but it does come in with built-in practice fidelity. So that is something that is also a plus.
And how much did it cost to build out the
actual file? Well, that's a good question. I don't think we could really tell you because we funded it in bits and starts, and I think our university would also say that a fair amount of in-kind kind of went into it. The new one is costing like $250,000, but it's not intervention specific, so it's something that anybody could license. I encourage people to think about, to my mind, this is how we have to go, and that tele strategies generally are really essential for us to do our work more efficiently, all the way from, you know, less driving around everywhere and more interacting, even if that interaction might be remote. So just, we were asked to talk a little bit about dissemination. We do a lot of dissemination. We have more than 40,000 downloads from our website every year. But these are some things that we also have been developing, comics and what we call e-learning tools. And these are little bite-sized chunks of professional development that can be inserted into different modalities. So we think that they could be used in a staff meeting. We use them in our online trainings. Or people can access them on our website. And they're, again, very much developed. These are totally developed from our youth and young adults, from their perspectives, based on their experience. I should say that in our AMP training, for example, our trainers are young people who have been through systems. So, I mean, these are people, these are young people who are not just helping us develop our interventions or our skills enhancement. They're actually delivering the training. So, these are developed from their experiences watching providers work with young people. And I can tell you that we have had that called a triggering experience for young people, not more than occasionally. But again, the focus is again on community, on kind of everyday life, and that the sort of, I think, starting point for all of this stuff is that treatment and diagnosis might come up, but it's not the starting point for how young people want to think about changing their lives and moving in more positive directions. So we have our comics. We actually are just on to our, they're sort of little mini series, and now we have four of them. So like just the first one is about natural support. It introduces the main characters. It touches on things like asking for help, identifying natural supports, a little bit of role playing. The guy does a role play with his dog. Asking for what natural support and help can look like, and how supportive pets. I mean, young people, we all do maybe love our pets, but our young people definitely love their pets. So the second one touches on basically a kind of a stigmatizing therapy experience the young man has, a feeling that it's not really responding to what he wants. And also touches on the positive power of humor, exercise, and of course, pets. Third one, similar thing, friendships, meeting people where they're at, and again, power of humor, friendship, and pets. And the one that this sort of leads up to is the Peer Run Drop-In Center, where they're headed to in the next one, which is forthcoming on the website any day now. So each of these, the comics and these other e-learning tools, come along with what we call ended up calling them a study guide. So basically, if you want to implement this or use it in your staff development, it's kind of like the teacher version of those readers that we all had when we were in school. So it kind of tells you what are the main points, what are some questions you could ask, what are some things you could point to. So hopefully, people will feel confident that they're just able to take these things and use them as part of professional developments. So we have developed a kind of a variety of these e-learning tools, and this is one of the more elaborate ones that has some animation in the beginning, but basically it's done in terms of a conversation of a provider and a young man, and it kind of talked, there's sort of different levels of responses, and you're supposed to pick actually the worst responses first, because it's kind of fun, you get to see the young man reacting in a kind of a bad way. But also then it gives a diagnosis. It says sort of like, this is why it's not a good response. And so you kind of move through, you go through this sort of branching scenario, and depending on what you say, you get the reaction from the young man and it moves into the next piece of the track. So we have, that's a blank slide. Anyway, we have several of these. We're working to build them as part of dissemination. And so far, the reaction, certainly the comics, have been extremely popular on our website. They've been the biggest downloads we ever had. So I encourage you to think about this kind of thing. If anybody wants to talk more about that stuff, we're happy to. We love them. So that's it, I think. Tamara, do you want to add anything? We also, Matthew Uretsky is here. He's also was part of our delegation. He's part of the proposed center that is no longer happening, but decided to come along anyway to meet you all. So just wanted to introduce them. Oh, thank you.